Okay, let's unpack this. For a whole generation of first-time buyers, especially here in Canada, the traditional starter home, you know, a modest place you buy and pay off, and it's increasingly a financial impossibility.
It really is. Housing prices have just completely outpaced wages.
So to even get into the market today, the math often requires an assist. It requires a rental helper.
That's the absolute core concept we're diving into today. The conventional wisdom is, well, it's out the window. The starter home isn't just a house anymore, it's a house that earns.
Right.
We're talking about strategically adding a secondary suite, a legal basement unit, or maybe a carriage house that just fundamentally changes the financial calculations.
And our mission in this deep dive is to see if this strategy really holds up. You, our listener, you shared a stack of sources on this, everything from bank lending formulas to complex tax codes. We're going to pull out the most important bits of knowledge.
Yeah, we need to figure out how these rental helpers affect, you know, your loan qualification, your tax liability, and I think this is crucial, your actual day-to-day life.
Because shared living is a huge deal.
It is. The initial benefit, though, it's deceptively simple, but it's incredibly powerful. Consistent rental income just lowers your effective housing cost.
So if you're looking at a, what, a $2,400 monthly mortgage payment, which is daunting,
Super daunting.
but you collect, say, $900 in rent from a tenant, your net cost of housing immediately drops to $1,500.
Exactly. Before utilities and other costs, of course. But that difference, that $900 cushion, is what shifts the math from, you know, impossible to just maybe.
Okay, so that brings us directly to the gatekeepers, the lenders. What are we actually talking about when we say rental helper in a formal financial context? Is it just like a roommate?
No, absolutely not just a roommate. When we talk to lenders and mortgage underwriters, we're referring to what they categorize as secondary suites or accessory dwelling units,
ADs.
ADUs.
Yeah.
The key distinction is that these are self-contained, separate living spaces. They have to have their own kitchen, their own bathroom, and often a separate entrance.
So these are typically those self-contained basement suites or the over-garage carriage houses that are getting more popular.
Exactly. And it's important you understand this isn't some informal agreement. Provinces actually define these legally, which is why lenders take them so seriously. The sources point out that jurisdictions like British Columbia, for instance, they formally define secondary suites right in their building code. That includes very specific construction and safety requirements.
So they're formally recognized dwellings, not just an extra room you happen to rent out.
That's the key.
Okay, so for buyers, the main appeal is that the potential rental income helps them qualify for a larger loan. It lets them get into the market years sooner. But the bank's math is notoriously complex, all that jargon. How does that guaranteed rent actually factor into the bank's decision?
That complexity, it really boils down to two ratios that mortgage lenders obsess over. The gross debt service, or GDS, and the total debt service, or TDS. These are the red lines you just cannot cross.
Okay, before we go deeper, can you just quickly remind us, for you, the listener, what exactly are GDS and TDS and why do they matter so much?
Of course. GDS measures the percentage of your gross income that goes toward housing costs. So that's your mortgage principal, interest, taxes, and heating. The guideline maximum for that ratio in Canada is generally 39%.
39%.
And TDS is the bigger picture. It measures all your debt payments, so housing plus credit cards, car loans, everything against your gross income. The max guideline for TDS, it's typically 44%.
So if you go over those, the bank just says no, too risky. So
Exactly.
if my income is too low to meet those ratios for the house I need, how does a potential $900 a month in rent fix my GDS?
This is where the crucial caveat comes in.
Yeah.
It's the real lending magic. Mortgage insurers like CMHC, they have guidelines that let lenders include a percentage of that gross rent to offset those ratios.
Percentage, not all of it.
Never all of it. They know tenancy is uncertain, so they might count, say, 50%, 70%, sometimes even 80% of the rent, and add that figure back to your gross income for the qualification math.
Okay, let's run a quick hypothetical just to make that solid. Say a buyer needs a $500,000 mortgage, and without any rental income, their GDS ratio is stuck at 32%. They fail.
Precisely. They fail that 39% test. Now, let's say they anticipate collecting $1,000 a month in rent. If the lender uses, say, 70% of that's $700 added to their effective annual income for qualification.
Wow.
And that boost in income often pulls their GDS ratio right back down below the 39% threshold. Suddenly, the whole purchase is viable, at least on paper.
That's powerful. But here's the key financial literacy message we have to hit home. the amount the lender uses for approval is not the same amount you should budget for in real life.
Absolutely, 100%. Lenders may count some of your rental income, but you should never, ever assume they'll count all of it. And you definitely shouldn't build your personal budget assuming 100% occupancy at the highest possible market rate.
It's the difference between what I qualify for and what I can actually live with comfortably.
That's it. Relying on a best-case scenario is just setting yourself up for some serious financial fragility.
That is the essential distinction.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move to the lived reality. When things go well, the benefits of this strategy are, well, they're substantial. They go way beyond just qualifying for the loan.
Oh, yeah. When it's executed well, the upsides create a powerful financial engine. We start, of course, with that lower effective housing cost. Just feeling that huge reduction in your net monthly payment, it's transformative.
And what do people do with that extra cash flow? The sources show it's often used pretty strategically.
That leads right to the second benefit, accelerated wealth building. That extra $900 a month can be dedicated entirely toward making extra mortgage payments. You could save years of interest, maybe shave a decade off your amortization.
Or build an emergency fund.
Critically, yes. Mm-hmm. Building an emergency fund big enough to withstand vacancy and repair costs.
And I think we sometimes forget the non-financial benefits, too. The sources also mention long-term flexibility.
That's a huge one. A suite may start as a financial necessity, you know, for the first 5 or 7 years, but once your finances are stable, it represents a massive asset. That space can then be used for aging parents, a critical need today.
For sure.
Or for adult children who are saving up, or it can just be a dedicated home office. It's an investment in your future flexibility.
And there's that systemic benefit, right? Supporting rental supply.
Mm-hmm.
CMHC is explicitly trying to increase the number of legal, safe rental units. So every time a buyer creates a legal suite, they're doing a small part to help the housing shortage.
Theoretically, yeah, it can be a win-win. But to get the true picture, we have to flip the coin. We have to look at the four areas of increased complexity, starting with the most visceral risk, cash flow.
That $2,400 mortgage payment is due on the first of the month, period. It doesn't matter if my tenant paid or if the unit has been empty for 3 weeks while I'm repainting.
Precisely. You are absorbing 100% of that cash flow and vacancy risk. So if your budget is so tight that you can't manage more than a few weeks without that rent, you're highly exposed.
So what's the advice?
The prudent message is this. Treat rental income as partially uncertain. You have to stress test your budget. Ask yourself, could I carry this home for 3 straight months without rent while still paying for everything else? If the answer is no, your down payment needs to be bigger or your purchase price needs to be lower. Simple as that.
The second area of complexity is regulatory risk, and this is the one that seems to cause the biggest, most unexpected headaches.
This is so critical. Way too many first-time buyers rely on the income from an illegal suite, one that doesn't comply with local zoning or building codes.
And these suites aren't just extra rooms.
No, they are subject to very strict rules designed to ensure life safety.
Can you give us an example? It sounds technical.
No, it is technical, but it's vitally important. We saw a source mention specific sections, like Section 9.37 of the BC Building Code. It sets out detailed requirements for things like fire separations, adequate exits, and ventilation.
These are not minor details.
Not at all. They're about protecting lives.
So if I buy a house with a basement apartment that looks great, but it wasn't built to code.
You've inherited a time bomb. Failure to comply can lead to costly correction orders from the city, or worst case, they can force you to decommission it entirely.
Wow.
We saw one source mention a couple in Vancouver who faced a $40,000 retrofit bill. Their suite lacked the required fire separation and a proper escape window.
$40,000.
That single cost effectively wiped out 2 years of their rental income, put them in a very serious bind.
That's a perfect illustration of why checking permits and compliance before you buy is non-negotiable.
It's the only way to ensure the income you're counting on is stable and legal.
Then there's the third risk, the non-financial one. Lifestyle impact. You are fundamentally sharing your property. Your personal space.
This is the cost you can't put on a spreadsheet. You have to acknowledge the reality of shared living. You know, potential parking disputes, noise, shared utilities, the emotional labor of coordinating boundaries.
Yeah.
It's not just managing a financial investment. It's managing a relationship that lives directly below you.
So is that financial gain of $900 a month worth the stress of hearing footsteps at 11 p.m.? Or coordinating who uses the shared laundry room for the 5 or 10 years it takes to get stable?
That is the essential personal question. The key is setting clear boundaries early. The sources suggest a rock-solid formal lease agreement that outlines everything, noise policies, shared spaces, communication channels to minimize conflict.
You're not just a homeowner.
You're buying a house, but you're also taking on the role of a landlord. And that role affects your home life profoundly.
Okay, the fourth area of complexity leads us directly into our final segment, tax implications. Rental income is taxable, but the really sticky part is what happens years down the road when you sell.
Exactly. While you can deduct certain expenses related to earning that rent, like a portion of utilities, insurance, maintenance, the biggest long-term complication involves the principal residence exemption, the PRE.
The PRE is usually a huge benefit, right? It means you don't pay capital gains tax on the profit from selling the house you lived in. So why does the rental suite turn this into a headache?
Because the CRA considers the portion of the house you rent out as an income-producing asset, not just your personal residence. And if you use a significant portion of the property to earn income, especially if you claim depreciation, which is a whole other topic, it can trigger what's called a change in use.
Wait, hold on. So if I'm using this suite just to survive the first 5 years, and the market value doubles in that time, am I really expected to pay capital gains on the profit from the rental portion? That sounds like a massive deterrent.
It can be. The tax system essentially treats it as if you sold the rental portion of your property, say 40% of the house at market value, to yourself.
Oh.
This is the concept of deemed disposition, and it can trigger capital gains liability on that 40% when you eventually sell the whole house. The consequence of not accounting for this can be a shocking tax bill years later.
That complexity just underscores the core advice.
Yeah.
You have to get professional tax advice before relying on rental income long term. You need a plan.
Absolutely. The difference between having a small home office versus a fully segregated rental suite is enormous when it comes to the PRE. Get professional advice up front.
Let's shift gears now to down payment strategies. This is the other half of the puzzle. You can buy sooner with a small down payment and pay for mortgage default insurance, or you can wait and save for that 20% to avoid the premium. How do the government savings tools fit into this?
The beauty of having strategic savings is that it builds resilience. It moves that rental income from a necessary survival tool to a powerful buffer.
And the government has two major tools for this. The First Home Savings Account, the FHSA, and the RRSP Home Buyers Plan, the HBP.
The FHSA is right now the most compelling tool for first-time buyers. It lets you save up to a $40,000 lifetime maximum. Crucially, your contributions are generally tax deductible.
Like an RRSP.
And your qualifying withdrawals, including all the growth, are completely tax-free.
Like a TFSA.
It's a double whammy of tax advantages designed to accelerate that down payment saving.
So if I contribute $8,000 a year to my FHSA, get a tax deduction, and then use it tax-free for my down payment, I've saved faster and cut my tax bill.
Precisely. Then you have the RRSP Home Buyers Plan, the HBP, which lets you borrow from your retirement savings tax-free, but you have to repay it over the next 15 years.
Okay.
The key takeaway, especially for the rental helper strategy, is this. If you use these tools to get a larger down payment, the rental income is no longer the precarious lifeblood of your mortgage payment.
It transforms into a security blanket.
It becomes a buffer and a potential accelerator for debt repayment. If you only need 10% down to get in, but you use the FHSA and HBP to get to 20% down, the smaller mortgage means you are way less dependent on that rent check.
And if your suite is vacant for 2 months?
You absorb that risk much more easily. It makes the whole strategy safer, transforming it from a desperate measure into a well-cushioned financial plan.
One that can withstand life's inevitable disruptions.
Right. If you're less dependent on the rent, you have more breathing room if interest rates rise, if a tenant is late, or if you face the unexpected $40,000 repair bill. Resilience is key.
We've covered a lot of ground today, from the technical math of lenders to lifestyle trade-offs and the deep complexities of tax. Let's synthesize this for our learner listener.
Okay. We've identified four key takeaways that every first-time buyer considering this needs to internalize. So, recap point one. Rental suites are a powerful tool, but they are absolutely not a magic trick. They inherently introduce complexity, a ton of responsibility, and risk.
Recap point two. Approval math and life math are two different things. Even if the lender approves you using 70% of the rent, build your own budget using conservative assumptions, maybe only 50% of market rent, to ensure you can survive a downturn.
Recap point three. Legality matters above all else. Do not rely on income from a suite unless you have verified the permits and confirmed it complies with all the codes. Non-compliance is a time bomb.
And recap point four. Use those registered plans, the FHSA and the HBP, to build your resilience. The more you can increase your down payment, the less you rely on that rent check. It transforms it into extra savings, not a survival mechanism.
And this leads to our final thought for you to mull over. We talked about stress testing your budget. If you've run the numbers and the bank approves you, don't just focus on small things. Focus on the single worst case scenario that you absolutely need a cash cushion for.
Calculate the cost of the largest maintenance expense a typical home faces, like replacing the furnace or a leaky roof, and combine that with the loss of 3 consecutive months of rent. If you can calculate that number and make sure you have it in cash or accessible credit, then you've measured your true financial resilience. That's the most important stress test of all.